me just first of all say happy Mother's Day to all of you who are mothers, and that I'm really pleased about the Earth Day event we had 2 weeks ago celebrating all of our mother. You know, we had 2,414 people who were on that event through Zoom, and another 464 who joined us through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter. So for a total of 2,878 people on the call, that's the most people that we've ever had on any event. And that was very exciting. And for those of us who worked on it, a huge relief because we hadn't ever tried to pull something off like that. And so it was exciting to see that we could do that and that it came across, I think, very well. If you missed that, you can actually see Dr. Hayhoe's comments on our CCL community. Second time around, it was just as good for me as the first time. So you can catch that if you missed it the first time. But anyway, welcome. And particularly if you're from a new chapter. So for instance, if you're from St. John's, Canada, Surrey, Canada, Southern Alberta, Canada, Nanaimo, Canada, Bengal, Gambia, and then in the U.S., Mitchell County, Iowa, Kansas City, Kansas, Henderson, Polk County, North Carolina, and Omaha, Nebraska. Thank you all so much for being on. We're excited about a new feature that we have on this month's call. Our guest speaker is Dr. Natasha D. Jarnett, who we're just, you know, lucky that we have a public health expert who's a member of our board. So she's been a huge resource to the organization for years in terms of speaking at conferences, both nationally and regionally, been on many of our calls. And it's just so lucky that we have an expert in the area that we can have on this particular call to deal with this particular moment. But we've added a feature. What we also have is we have 60 action teams in Citizens Climate Lobby, which give people a chance to participate in an avenue extended beyond their chapter. So our health action team is a very big, active chapter. We have an agriculture chapter, a military chapter, a faith chapter. So there's a lot of ways you can participate. Well, what we found is when there was one person in your group who could text us, who could chat us, who could write Q&As during the session, we could deal with it. But once we found that everybody was calling in remotely, and hopefully what you'll be doing as soon as this session's over is you'll be joining your local chapter's session remotely, that it's a lot of people to deal with. So three people from our health action team graciously offered to join the call and deal with questions during the presentation. So that's Dr. Lisa Del Buono and Dr. Lori Byron and Rob Byron. So thank you so much for making yourself available. And then there's several members of the CCL staff who are on to answer any technical questions during the session. So we're hoping we've kind of beefed up our resources and can deal with more interaction during the course of the call. It's something that will continue to develop over time. So we're very, very excited again to have Dr. Natasha D. Jarnett on the call. And what I'd like to start, Dr. D. Jarnett, is just in terms of information. You know, we're dealing with a nasty pandemic. And so I think one of the things that's always important when you are working with something like this, where we're not, the rest of us aren't public policy experts, is for you, where do you start in going for trusted information and where do you stay away from so that you think you're getting the best, most accurate up-to-date information? What are the sources that you go to and what are the sources that you stay away with? And again, thank you so much for being here. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. And I'm just so grateful to be here. I realize that there's a lot happening around us. There's a pandemic happening around us. There's much suffering going on. But I'm really grateful to be called on to have this opportunity. And with that, I do want to take a second, if you don't mind, to thank our first responders, our folks that are working in public health and environmental health and medical services. Thank you to the essential workers who are ensuring that we still have our needs met despite these tough times. And you know, my condolences to those who have unfortunate experiences in their families and beyond with COVID. But I'm really glad that you've asked about trusted resources of information. And I'm glad that you asked because this information is changing so rapidly. So I worry when I speak that within a few days, what I share is going to be obsolete. We're still learning about this condition. We're still learning about the effects and the impacts, and it's changing really rapidly. So I'm really glad to share with you where I find some trusted information. I lately actually have been watching a lot of webinars from science-based organizations. I found that to be a great place to get new late-breaking information. In addition, I want to share with you what I share with my students. I teach at George Washington University, and something that I share with my students is to look to reputable sources. CDC is a reputable resource. I work for the National Environmental Health Association. We have a website on COVID that is a great resource. I also look to the World Health Organization and Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Resource Center, as these have some latest information and mapping information that's really helpful to understand from different angles. As I said, science-based resources are really important. I encourage students in particular to look to peer-reviewed science journals, government agencies, as well as even major magazines or newspapers. Also, of course, the news can be a reliable source. Look for reputable news agencies as resources. But what I do tell students and advise students to do is when you read an article, for example, online, look for the research that's being referenced in that article. Look to the original source, review that, see if you draw the same conclusions. So in terms of information not to trust, it's the exact opposite. Anything that doesn't include sources of their information. I personally put an extra eye of scrutiny on opinion-based pieces. I definitely look to resources that are science-based, and I want to put a red flag out to watch for clickbait. This is very common in social media. So if you see a very sensational title that's like, oh, I've got to see what that's about. Before you do that, look and see what website that's from. Make sure it is a reputable, known resource, before exposing yourself to something that may not actually be factual. At a time of coronavirus, we need to arm ourselves with factual information. And, you know, the mantra has been said often, facts over fear. And we have the power to do that.
Great. Thank you. And thank you so much for saying the words about the first responders also. That's important. And I'm really glad you said it. So there's been really a wide variety of disparities community to community to how the people are reacting to the virus. Can you just say a little bit about this and some of the factors that have contributed to it?
Certainly, and I appreciate you asking about this. I want to be clear that we're all at risk, but COVID is uncovering race and ethnicity-based differences in mortality and diagnosis and cases. And this does reflect some of the systemic consequences of health disparities that have prevailed over time. I am appreciative that these health disparities are becoming a more mainstream topic of discussion. Public health has discussed these often, but I am really pleased to see a much wider audience having discussions around these health disparities. So I think we are clear in understanding that coronavirus does not discriminate, but there are some conditions and some factors that are resulting in higher exposure rates or prevalence or death in certain populations. So in terms of the conditions in the communities that are more susceptible, the African-American population, African-Americans are dying at higher rates. African-Americans make up 13% of the population here in the US. There's a recent study that looked at coronavirus disparities across the nation, and they found that African-Americans are 52% of the coronavirus cases here in the U.S. and 58% of the coronavirus deaths. So that is a disparity. What contributes to that? Well, African-Americans do have higher cases of heart disease and lung disease and diabetes. And as we know, these are some of the key risk factors for susceptibility to coronavirus. But there's more to that if you dig deeper. It's more than the pre-existing illnesses. There's also higher air pollution exposure in African-American populations, or African-American communities, I should say. And there's been a recent study that has shown that even small increases in air pollution can significantly increase risk of coronavirus mortality. So when you overlay this with pre-existing illnesses, this is a recipe for a problem. African-Americans also tend to be more exposed. We tend to work jobs that are less able to telework. There's lower access to healthcare, and there's differences in healthcare. And we can't negate the elephant in the room that racism plays a role. Racism can be found at the heart of poverty. It can be found at the heart of limited employment opportunities and poor investments in education and infrastructure in our communities, as well as unhealthy environments, as I shared about air pollution. But there are additional groups that also have shown disparate relationships to coronavirus. The Native Americans, they have some predisposition as well as African Americans when it comes to chronic diseases. For example, Native Americans have higher incidence of diabetes. And then what has also been exposed about this is that there are some Native American communities across the U.S. that don't have running water in their homes. This makes mitigating coronavirus especially challenging. Immigrant communities are also more susceptible when it comes to coronavirus. There's differences in access to healthcare there. And then many are more likely to be frontline workers. And then there's been much news on the disparity in older adults, where they also have many pre-existing illnesses. And then those that are also in nursing home facilities are especially susceptible. So those are some key disparities that I wanted to bring light to. There are others, but I'm so appreciative that health disparities are coming more and more into the conversation. I think it's of urgent importance as we look to solving the situation that we're currently facing.
Great, thank you. And also, if you have questions as we're going along, if you put those in the Q&A, we do have some doctors who are monitoring the call who'll be able to answer some health-related questions. We have our staff also monitoring for questions that we'll be hopefully having time to have Dr. DeJarnette answer after our initial questions are done. Let's just talk about the mental toll this is taking on people for a little bit. At this point, probably most people know somebody. One of our staff had a pretty rough case for about 4 weeks. She's doing really well now, but that was nerve-wracking. Even though she was young and healthy, I was anxious every day about it. And then you have people at home trying to work in an environment where it used to be some of them were already teleworkers, and now their children are sitting on laptops next to them and they were trying to do work. So can you just say something about, you know, maybe all of us are a little more stressed out right now, but that's going to be part of the new normal for a while.
Absolutely. Another thing that I'm really appreciative of is that we are including mental health conversations right alongside the physical health conversations. And I think that is very important, often goes under the radar. There's so many stressors. The illness itself is a stressor. The vulnerable populations, the older adults, those with chronic illness, children who may not understand what's happening around them, those that are income insecure, bear a heavy mental toll of this. And you hit on so many of the fears. There's so many stressors, exposure to this condition, job loss, economy, and how that affects our families. And then those who are teleworking and homeschooling at the same time, there's isolation. And there's even a role that domestic violence is playing, and economic stressors and suicide risk. There's a lot to be concerned about here. And we've got our routines have just completely transformed. School, work, church, shopping, sports, much of that's happening right at home, if at all. And then we have the grief of these experiences, plus also the grief of knowing somebody that might be affected by COVID, or knowing someone who knows someone that has been personally affected. So CDC has offered some suggestions, and I highly encourage visiting CDC's website. They do have a page on mental health and COVID, which I'll be happy to also share through the chat. But CDC has also offered some things that can be done to reduce the stress. First, acknowledging that traumatic stress does exist and can impact anyone, that we learn the feelings, acknowledge the symptoms of physical fatigue as well as mental fatigue. And so physical symptoms might show in terms of fatigue or illness, and mental symptoms may include fear and withdrawal and guilt. We also need to have on hand a menu of personal self-care activities, things that make you happy, things that you're able to do. Have this list handy so you can go to this list in these moments. I heard someone recently say, take an hour a day for yourself. Everybody may not be able to do that, but if you can, it could be of great added benefit. And then always asking for help if you're feeling overwhelmed or concerned that COVID-19, the impacts of it are affecting you or your ability to care for yourselves or your families. So there's much that can be done. CDC also has a disaster distress hotline that's on that same webpage that I shared about. And then there's also a domestic violence awareness hotline number that's also available there. So seeking resources, I absolutely advocate for that.
Great, thank you. So we kind of backed off from Congress for a month, saying we were going to let them deal with, the crisis. And I think that was the right move. And, everybody be hearing the actions a little bit, as we're going to try and see every member of the House and Senate again in June. And we're, the Congressional Management Service now says that 79% of offices are ready to deal with things other than COVID. And we have a very good set of liaisons who are monitoring where the offices to see who it's ready to move with. But, that being said, as we start to transition back to more activity with working with Congress on climate, what do we learn from this that we think we could apply to dealing with climate change?
All right. I love this conversation. So one thing I want to point out that is important to learn from this is that air pollution matters. Air pollution matters. I think that I'm preaching to the choir right now, of course. We already knew that air pollution increased risk of heart disease and asthma, for example. But now we know that the consequence of long-term air pollution exposure might also increase risk of mortality to conditions like coronavirus. And there's some data to support this. I think that on the other side of that, we've also learned that we can pollute less. We're seeing stories from all over the globe where pollution levels are down. We can pollute less. This is largely a consequence or benefit of physical distancing, but let's find how we can continue to build on this momentum of less pollution. Also, something really important. We talked about the disparities. I think that what we can learn from this to apply to climate is that we cannot address climate meaningfully without also addressing injustice. Health disparities are there. Health disparities are existing. Pollution has made our frontline communities more susceptible to a variety of health conditions and coronavirus. And climate change is a great threat multiplier for our most vulnerable populations. All the while, thinking about climate change as a great threat multiplier, we're expecting a very active hurricane season. We're still dealing with COVID, and I cannot speculate on future projections of COVID, but we're expecting an active hurricane season. And if there is an overlap, what does this mean for shelters? What does this mean for relocating? What does this mean for hospitals that are already overstressed? And I think that what we also learn from this is the need to protect our most vulnerable populations, to build and support policies that ensure that our most vulnerable populations are taken care of and cared for, and that will ensure that we will all benefit from action.
Great, okay, we'll ask Flannery in just a moment to tell us kind of the themes and the questions. But I just wanna, I know we can't say what a new normal is gonna look like yet, but I'm just thinking back to after 9/11 and when we first had to go to the airport and they made us take our shoes off and we acted like it was the end of the world, you know, and like, oh, you have to take your computer out of your bag. Oh, who's could be, you know, insulted like that? How do you think we'll do adjusting to a new normal? Because there's going to be a new normal. We don't know what it's going to look like, but do you think we'll be able to adjust?
and, you know, I've heard somebody even refer to it now as the new abnormal. We're even okay. Shifting past the new norm. I think that in the new normal, what I would like to see is that we call for data-driven decision-making, is that we call for evidence-based risk communication. We are there. We as volunteers and members of Citizens Climate Lobby, we're there. And we need to continue to support this. I also want to put upon us the urgency to act is now, is this moment. And I think that's what this should inspire in our new normal, is that we don't have time to wait. And the IPCC has already told us we have a very short window to act. On both coronavirus as well as climate change, the urgency is here now. And I want to share with you a quote from Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King that I think is timeless and extremely timely for our moment right now. We are now faced with the fact that tomorrow is today. We are confronted with the fierce urgency of now. In this unfolding conundrum of life and history, there is such a thing as being too late. There is no time for apathy or complacency. This is a time for vigorous and positive action.
Thank you for that too. Flannery, what are the trends you're seeing in the Q&A that we should ask Dr. DeJarnette?
Sure. So one question that has gotten a handful of thumbs up, so several people want to know. This person asks about the worldwide social lockdown, the reduction in activity that we've seen, and they're pointing out that this gives us a glimpse into a world with much less fossil fuel related pollution. And so they're asking about if there's research going on or any information you can share about the public health impacts of this pollution pause.
That's a great question. Anything I could offer would be speculation, and I hesitate to speculate, but I, like those that posed the question, will be very excited to see if there's some research on the horizon, or research that is being planned that is exploring what health outcomes result when there's lower pollution levels. So I'm sitting at the edge of my seat, hopeful that there will be some research that will uncover that. I think it will be so valuable. I think we will all be using that as resources to inform, as I said, this data-driven decision-making. So I do not know, but I am very interested to see.
Flannery, we've got time for a couple more.
Okay, great. Another theme that's emerging is people are sharing different perspectives on mask wearing. And someone has asked, how can we counter polarization and politicization against these practices that are meant to keep us safe? And they point out that wearing masks in public now is viewed by some people as a political statement. So do you have thoughts on mask wearing and how it's perceived?
Oh, that is really interesting. I follow CDC's guidelines. And when CDC said that we should be wearing masks in public places, that is what I have done on the few, you know, occasions that I've gone out. I live in the state of Maryland, and our governor has said that you have to wear masks if you're going into any enclosed public space. And so I find it really interesting that this is taking on a political slant. But to combat that I follow the guidelines of CDC and I recommend that others do the same to protect themselves and their families. There's also some really interesting videos. I believe it's on New England Journal of Medicine's website. I told you, I stick to peer-reviewed journals for my sources of information. But there's someone wearing a mask and coughing and showing the dispersion of this. And then they've also got some data on there showing how much your risk goes down if both you and the person that you're sharing company with both have masks on. So it's data driven, but it is CDC's recommendations.
Flannery, do you have a couple more things you want to ask?
Well, this one might be a little bit off topic, but folks are very curious, Dr. DeJarnette, about the bat on the wall behind you.
Well, I am so glad to hear that. I'd love to share about the bat. The bat is a Louisville Slugger bat. I did my graduate studies at University of Louisville, and my colleagues provided this bat to me when I left DC to move. I'm sorry, left Louisville to move to DC. So the bat is extra special to me, and I'm really glad that people noticed it and asked about it. Thank you.
You just made Ricky Bradley, my colleague, very happy.
Oh, yeah.
Sasha.
Good.
Do you have anything else, Flannery?
Just clarifying. Okay. Someone has asked, what's the primary source for the statistic you mentioned of 52% of cases and 58% of deaths being in African Americans? Folks are interested in maybe citing that in some of their outreach that they're doing.
Absolutely. I'll be glad to share the link. The article was picked up in multiple sources, and CNN Health featured it. So I'll be glad to dig and share that link with you all.
Great. Well, thank you again so much. I mean, I feel lucky every day that you're part of our board. You do such amazing work there, and that we can count on you as a resource in these times when we need trusted messengers. Thank you so much, and appreciate it so much, Dr. DeJarnette.
Thank you so much. I'm just so grateful for the opportunities. Thank you all for all you do. You inspire me every day.
Great. Thank you so much. Okay, cool. Well, that was great. So I want to talk about just one data point since last month's call. So one of the things we track is published media. And it's pretty tricky to get letters to the editors published right now. In my paper, they only print the letter section 3 times a week. And it's tough to get in there because everything is almost COVID related. Well, in the month of April, we had 135 op-eds published. We've never had anything close to 135 op-eds published, and we had a total of 465 media pieces. I think that's a statement of how this group responds, because I did ask you last month to back off of Congress for just a short period of time, but it was important that we continue to build political will. And getting an op-ed published in a paper is a pretty high bar with a newspaper. They are looking for a certain standard, something that they can say this is part of their paper. So for everybody who got one published, for everybody who submitted one, that is really remarkable. And I thought it was the exact right kind of rallying from this organization, knowing that we were going to give Congress a short break, that we would respond by being extra strong in the media. Also, I want to talk about what we're doing this month, both in Canada and the US. In Canada, what we're going to be doing is having virtual meetings with your MP. So please make sure you're setting that up. In the US, the first action is to begin to plan your lobby meeting for June. I want to talk about June in just a moment, but that's the first thing we want you to start doing, is working together as a group to plan your meeting. You know, usually when the June conference happens, we have everybody call in a few days before the conference. That's not viable now because they're not in the office. They don't have the switchboards to be able to work with. What we're talking about is mostly an aide with a cell phone. So instead of calling in advance of the June conference, what we'll be doing is doing a mail campaign. We'll be asking you to email your members. They keep telling us that it's important. Action on climate change is important. And so we will be doing that. But at this point, what we're asking you to do to begin the process of scheduling an appointment. We're also asking you to learn a new social media skill. Listen, people, all of us have got to get with the new world. You know, this may not be the most comfortable thing for everybody. My marketing department kind of gave up on me on Twitter, but I think I'm going to rally and I'm going to learn Instagram, because we all need to make sure we're functioning in the modern world. So we're asking you together as a group to pick up a new social media skill. And then also, we want you to really go promote the June conference to everybody around you. You know, the highlight for me every year is us getting together in June, because there's something really remarkable that happens when you get a lot of CCLers together. And we can't do that live. I was very anxious about, could we do it virtually? And very encouraged by what happened on Earth Day. So I'm excited about what's going to happen. But there's some people who've never been able to come to DC. In some people's cases, it's just a carbon footprint issue. And I have complete respect for people who refuse to come because they don't want to deal with the carbon footprint that goes. Personally, I have no guilt about going to DC. I think that our going there is absolutely essential. I think what we have to do is important, and that it's worth the cost, even though the cost is significant. But that's the other piece. For some people, it's just never worked financially to come. So particularly for those people who've never been able to join us for June, I know it's going to not be quite the same experience that we all have when we get together. But we do think we're very excited about what we do have planned. The conference is going to be June the 13th and the 14th. The 13th is going to be a little over 4 hours of education. We'll start with a plenary session, and then we'll have breakouts for about 2 hours. Some of them will be very short, about 20 minutes. Some of them will be a half hour. And then we'll have a closing plenary at the end of the day, approximately 30 minutes long. And included in that will be a message from our Government Affairs Vice President, Dr. Danny Richter, about our path forward. For those of you who've been able to come to June, that's always been a meaningful part of our conference, and that will be a feature of this year's conference. We're excited about some of the organizations that we've got speaking at the conference. The co-lead of Healthcare Without Harm. There's a gentleman who used to run a coal company who now works to eliminate coal. We've had a lot of appetite in the organization for sessions with Braver Angels. We sold that session out for Earth Day, and so we'll add a session for that in June. I'm not surprised that this organization would sell out something like Braver Angels. To me, this is one of the really remarkable features of the number of people who are willing to go to work on themselves to try and unlock their own personal biases so that they are as open as they possibly can be in working with people. So we'll about be a little over 4 hours on the 13th, and then the 14th are going to be sessions where it takes a little bit more time. So you can't do a Braver Angel session in an hour. So those will be around 2 hour sessions on Sunday the 14th. And that will include a deep dive on policy. So things that take a little bit more time, you can participate however you want. You could just do the 13th. You could just do the 14th. You could do all of it. We'll be recording most of it, so it'll be available to you. But do register so you make sure you have a spot. These lines hold 10,000 people. I hope we can push to the limit of what Zoom can handle. Are we doing a lobby day? Yes, we are doing a lobby day. That's going to be handled by the local chapters. So there'll be separate training. The scheduling of people will be handled separately from what we'll be doing in June. So if you would like to be part of a lobby team, please make sure you let your group leader or your liaison know. And knowing that, our liaisons and our group leaders have been working with their member in the House and Senate in Canada with their MPs for, in the most case, a long period of time. We know where the office is. We know where the aides are. We want to work with them where they are. And our liaisons and our group leaders will design those sessions so that they're most productive for the member of Congress. It might mean some of us aren't in lobby meetings. That's fine. What we want to do is making sure that we're moving the ball forward with the actual members of Congress. So we will have lobby training. We will have the primary and secondary asks out to you no later than May the 28th, which is one of the training sessions associated with the lobbying. And so it might be to you ahead of time. We believe that that should give you at least a couple of weeks to plan your meetings, make sure you know exactly what you're going to be asking based on where your member is and how we can move them forward. Last thing I want to say is this. We've dealt with tough things together, and we've made it together because of each other. I feel very lucky to be part of an organization where you always feel like you're such a part of a big team working together to do something. You know, I'm grateful that we have an expanded team on this call now, the three doctors who joined us, the many more staff than we usually needed to house the call, that we have Dr. Desjarnais to be here to support us. So I'm grateful to have a team to deal with these hard, difficult times that we will make our way through. Last thing I want to say is this. We just borrowed $3 trillion as a country. We borrowed $3 trillion. We have the only solution that pays for itself. Government spending is going to become a problem pretty soon, I believe, here. And if we have a solution that makes the air water, makes the water cleaner, and it pays for itself, I think that's going to make our argument even more compelling. All right, everybody, we've set up the June conference, so it's in conjunction with we ordinarily have this call. So we'll see you then. Thank you again, Dr. Desjarnais, and all of you for being on the call. Appreciate it. Have a great week, everybody.